This morning we're going to talk about a general overview of eating disorders. We're going to take the broadest perspective possible and talk about it from the aspect of definitions and development and then what you do to deal with an eating disorder. So we're going to talk about those three things about eating disorders. Start with definitions. The most, the eating disorder with the highest profile, with the most publicity or the most notoriety, what is it?
Anorexia.
Anorexia nervosa. For many years, it was called the Golden Girl syndrome or the Golden Girl disease because it was assumed to be the sole property of upper-class, rich, white women. And we know that not to be the case now, and yet it continues to have some almost like prestige or status if somebody's anorexic. It's like, oh, wow. And we'll talk a little bit about why that's the case in a few minutes. The word anorexia itself simply means loss of appetite. So the term anorexia nervosa would seem to imply that the eating disorder is a loss of appetite because of a bad case of nerves. And in many ways, that's a misnomer because, number one, anorexics don't lose their appetites, especially in the early stages of the disease. In the later stages of the disease, they oftentimes do lose their appetites. But in the early stages, that's part of the payoff, isn't it? When you're hungry and don't eat anyway. And so it's really not about a loss of appetite at all. The best way to understand it is as the self-starvation syndrome. Anorexia is defined specifically with three criteria that have to be there. You have to have at least 15% of your body weight loss. You have to have not had a menstrual cycle in at least 3 months. And there has to be present that distortion in body image in which you see yourself literally as different or bigger than an accurate perception of what your body's like. Those are the three fundamental criteria for anorexia. Of all of the women in the United States between the ages of 18 and 35 years old, approximately 1% of them at any given time are anorexic. That doesn't sound like a whole lot. We'll translate that into numbers in just a few minutes to help you understand it, the impact of eating disorders. But women 18 to 35 years old. And we'll talk a lot about why anorexia is seen more among women than men. It's not exclusively a female disorder. We suspect that a lot of male marathoners may well be anorexic in terms of anorexia nervosa, having an actual eating disorder. And we'll talk about that. Some of the symptoms of anorexia are things like loss of body temperature. We call it hypothermia, where you're actually more cold all the time. And in response, your body grows a fine kind of downy hair across much of your skin. It's called lanugo, and that's to help insulate your body. Your attention and your concentration are decreased. Your irritability may be increased. You may begin to feel more lethargic. Initially, you may feel more energized because of the rush of not having to eat, even when you're hungry. But eventually, it'll start depleting your appetite, and you'll start feeling more run down, as well as being unable to concentrate and being able to pay attention. Anorexia begins to affect you physically in all of the ways that starvation affects you. That means that specifically it starts to hurt every system in your body, your brain, your heart, your lungs, your liver, your kidney, all begin to suffer from the impact of self-starvation. We first learned about those physical effects from studying concentration camp victims and then some experiments that we did in Minnesota back in the 40s, just after World War II, and with volunteer subjects. And we see that many of the same symptoms of depression and of even psychosis can be caused just by starving yourself. You can begin to have hallucinations, food hoarding, you know, where you hold it all to yourself. I had one anorexic patient one time who kept 6 or 8 quarts of frozen yogurt in her freezer all the time, not to eat, but just to have it in case she wanted it. You kind of hold on to it because you never know for sure when you're going to get it or when it's going to be available the next time. When anorexics die, they die from the effects of starvation. And we'll talk about that along with bulimia in just a second. Bulimia is the second most widely known eating disorder, and there are more bulimics than there are anorexics. Bulimia, the word bulimia actually means ox hunger. I don't know if anybody's ever eaten a whole ox, but some binges get that pretty big, just about, don't they? By definition, bulimia includes large amounts of food in a short period of time, at least 3 times a week, for at least 3 months. Those are the technical criteria to be bulimic, as well as then some way of ridding yourself of that food. But in terms of understanding the bulimic person in your family, or understanding yourself, what you have to do is translate this into a psychological definition. And the best way to do that then is to think about it as the binge-purge syndrome or cycle, and define binging and purging specifically. For instance, how many of you feel as though you've binged when you just eat an ordinary meal? Feels like a binge, doesn't it? Or you swore that you wouldn't eat anything that day, and then you ate some crackers and celery, and so you felt like you were binging. Because it's a psychological term, not really as much to do with quantity of food. So it's more about two things. First one is this: eating out of control. When your eating is out of control, then it feels like a binge. Now, if your control was nothing, then anything feels like you're out of control. So that's why it feels like a binge to you, see? Or it may be full-blown binging, you know, like in that movie with Meredith Baxter Burney, where she, Kate Secret's name of it, where she hits the fast food chain all the way down the street. And you may have been there. You know, you do Burger King for the first round, and then McDonald's for the second round, and then the Circle K on the way home, and the grocery store before you ever started, or whatever it may be. Some people binge in that fashion. Other people binge a little bit at a time all day long. We call them grazers. Graze binging. Again, it's eating out of control. And the other way to define a binge is this: eating my feelings. Do you know what I mean by that? What do I mean, Mary Kay? Stuffing your feelings? Any of those feelings, anger, stress, loneliness, eating in response to these feelings that I don't know what to do with, in a way that will maybe make them go down, stuff them down so that I won't be aware of them anymore. So it's literally a way of stuffing them down out of my awareness. A lot of times, now I know this sounds illogical, but I think you'll also understand what I mean. When somebody tells me, I can't eat, I'm too full, what I'll tell them is, if you'll talk your feelings out, you'll have more room for food. And then you'll be able to eat a normal amount. Does that make sense? It's not biologically true. Your stomach isn't full because you swallowed your feelings. But psychologically, it really makes sense. If you have stuffed your feelings, you're not going to be able to accept food in a healthy and normal way. And so if you'll start to release those feelings, you'll be able to accept food in a much more healthy and normal way. So binging is about eating out of control or eating your feelings. And then how about the purge? Vomiting is the most common form of purging, self-induced vomiting. Oh, and by the way, I had a mom call us once and say, I know my daughter's bulimic, but I'm not sure she's bad enough to have to be there because she doesn't have to make herself throw up. She just kind of leans over and it happens. And what I need to tell you is that means she's real bad, that she's already purged, vomited so much that she's lost her natural gag reflex. Your gag reflex is there to keep stuff out that shouldn't go down. And she's already lost that reflex. Now, that reflex may be returned as she gets healthier. It's not always a permanent loss, but it may be a permanent loss. So self-induced vomiting. What else? What other kinds of purges? Laxative abuse. Diuretic abuse. Compulsive exercise. We'll just say just a word about these. These are the major ones. In the history of the church, you know, fasting has been one of the spiritual disciplines. The church fathers and the scriptures also have encouraged us to go without food in such a way that our concentration is freed to concentrate on God and what He wants in our lives. That's not a good spiritual discipline for eating disordered people. Why? Because there's too good a chance it's a purge, right? So when you're fostering or cultivating your spiritual life, don't include fasting as a spiritual discipline.
too easy to be rationalizing it and calling it a purge. You've been there. I'm fasting for God. Yeah, right. You don't want to get. You want to be skinny. Compulsive exercising. I'll do in a second. Diuretics or water loss pills. I know you can identify with this. It's the feeling that the normal amount of fluid in your tissues becomes so uncomfortable. It feels like you're bloated, that is, fat. And so if you can take water pills and lose that water, maybe you'll be skinnier. And we'll talk about the danger of that. But eating disordered women oftentimes even restrict their fluid intake, not just their food intake, so that they can feel skinny. And diuretic abuse is a particularly dangerous form of purge, and we'll talk about why. Laxative abuse, it functions in the same way. It flushes so much of the fluid out of your body, as well as the waste in your intestinal system, that it leaves you feeling skinny, that is, dehydrated, really. And, secondly, it leaves you with that flat belly feeling. Now, that really doesn't have a lot to do with your weight, but it feels like a payoff, doesn't it? Real frankly, there's two reasons. One is because your pants usually fit a little looser for a few hours. But the other reason is laxative abuse is oftentimes correlated with some degree of sexual abuse or sexual dysfunction, or both. That there's some way that if I can flush it out and have a flat belly, I won't have to be so conscious or self-conscious about my sexuality. And so a lot of times we see that present with women who are struggling with sexual issues. Vomiting, laxatives, and diuretics all abuse the body in the same way, especially laxatives and diuretics. And it's this. When you flush all the fluids out of your system, either by vomiting or by too much going to the bathroom, either way, it leaves your body without the essential elements that make your nervous system work. Sodium and potassium, in particular, are the ones we're talking about. They are chemicals in your body that make the nervous system function smoothly so that your muscles get real clear messages from your nervous system and then function smoothly. When you don't have enough potassium or sodium, your muscles get unclear messages in your nervous system and they start to cramp up. Runner's cramp is an example of that. What do you do when you start getting cramps in your muscles from running too long? How do you fix it? Stretching, or that's before you do it, so you won't do that, or sometimes afterwards, but what else? Drink Gatorade. Why? Because Gatorade's loaded with sodium and potassium, and it restores those, we call them electrolytes, it restores those in your fluid system so that your central nervous system then functions better and your muscles work smoothly. If they don't, they keep cramping and spasming if they don't have enough sodium and potassium. Now, there's one particular muscle in your body that when it spasms, you're in trouble. What muscle is that? Your heart. See, a heart spasm can kill you if it's significant enough. So that's how heart attacks happen with bulimics. The sodium and potassium drops so low that all of their muscular system starts spasming. Now, you may have felt that. You may have had serious heart chest pain before when you're in the midst of your eating disorder. And that's why. It can leave long-term damage. Not necessarily. Some women's heart and reproductive systems and everything are completely restored. Our bodies are incredible about how much abuse they can take and still bounce back. You can leave your heart with a permanent heart murmur, which means an irregular beating rhythm. You can leave it. You can leave yourself with some permanent heart enlargement, which leaves you at risk for heart attack. So it can be real serious. Of same age range. Of all of the women in the country between the ages of 18 and 35, about anywhere from 8 to 10% are bulimic. So there's 10 times as many bulimics as there are anorexics. In total, there's about 11% of the women in this age range that are anorexic or bulimic. Let's put that in numbers for a minute. Let's use ASU as an example. Arizona State University campus has about 40,000 students. Let's say half of those are women, that'd be 20,000. How many of them would have anorexia or bulimia? 11% of 20,000 is about 2,200 students. 2,200 women on one campus have anorexia or bulimia, times how many campuses in the world? And that's just college campuses. That doesn't include high school. That doesn't include out of college. There are a bunch of women in the country. We estimate as many as 7 to 9 million women suffering from anorexia or bulimia at any given time.
put down the rice. So when I was reading the book by Sherry Booth, it said that estimated 1 million, and now it's, you know, 8 million. I know that was written a long time ago, but what's causing it to just...
A couple of different things, and we'll talk about that here in just a minute when we talk about how eating disorders develop, because that's a real good question. How come it's increasing so dramatically? And it is. This is, by the way, is epidemic proportions. If there were this many cases of flu at one time, it would be declared a flu epidemic. Okay, so this is epidemic proportions. And number two, eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness. How many people commit suicide from depression? Quite a few, but not as many as die from eating disorders. More people die from eating disorders than any other mental illness. That's sad. It's also kind of scary. I don't like using scare tactics, but you need to face the facts that this isn't just kind of started eating too much. These are serious issues that need to be dealt with. What else do we need to say about? Oh, let's say another word about compulsive exercising. How do you know when exercising is compulsive and therefore a purge and not just part of a healthy lifestyle? When you can't live without it, and when other things in your life start to suffer, so you make sure you get it. You see? Then you can define it as compulsive. You get quite a bit of exercise around here. There's so much walking, and then you have some equestrian program, and then you have a dance or walking class that's, 3 times a week? And then we're going to start putting some stuff on the weekends in terms of scheduled recreational stuff and that kind of thing. And yet, I know that some of you still exercise in your rooms. And if you're sneak exercising, what does that tell you it probably is about? See? It's probably about controlling my weight, not about being in good shape, about being fit. Now, let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about the development of an eating disorder. And to do that, we've got to start talking about the cultural impact on women about bodies. April, specifically in answer to your question, this is one of the reasons why the rate of eating disorders continues to go up. There's still so much more pressure on women to be thin than there is on men. Now, there's more pressure on men to be thin. There's been some positive benefits to the fitness fad in terms of helping us all be more fitness conscious and weight conscious. However, it's much more emphasized for women, and it's not about fitness. In our culture, what all does thinness get equated with? What does it mean to be thin? Popular, successful, disciplined, self-controlled, good-looking, beautiful, sexy, intelligent. Does a thin woman ever stay home on Friday nights? Well, no way. She's always got a date, right? Right? Is it really true? Do you know anybody who's thin and is lonely? Yeah. I mean, it's not a real parallel, is it? Not a real synonym. Smart women are always more intelligent. Two people apply for a job. One's thin and one's fat. Who gets the job? The thin one. The thin will get the job because she'll be assumed to be more intelligent and more self-controlled. You've let that lie stand, haven't you? Somebody comes up to you and goes, "My, you must be self-controlled. Look how thin you are." And you didn't tell her, "Oh, that's all right. I bend over the toilet." You don't correct that misperception, do you? Because that's what they believe. It's like, wow, she must really be self-controlled. It's not true. Yeah. See, I don't know any synonym that automatically fits with thinness. And to emphasize it even more, what do we assume about people who are overweight? Lazy? Dumb? Couldn't enjoy sex. That's only thin people only do that. I mean, we assume thinner people have a higher sex drive, which isn't true. Out of control. Doesn't care about themselves. Another one is happy, right? Fat, dumb, and happy. Is that true? People overweight automatically happy? No. People thin automatically happy? See, there's no correlation. Now, let me give you an example to understand this a little more. This is just a symbol or a metaphor. It's not an accurate thing. But I want to talk about intelligence in our population. This is called a normal distribution curve, or a bell-shaped curve. You get this in math, like in statistics, yeah, in high school or college. And I want to show you about intelligence. In our society, there are about 2.5% of the people who have an IQ of 120 or greater. We call them geniuses. They're incredibly brilliant. Okay? So there's a bunch of folks with an IQ of 120. And, you know, they're the ones who can do anything without hardly trying. Now, there are other people down here at the other end, and there's about 2.5% of them also, who have an IQ of 70 or less. They are mentally retarded. They may be mildly mentally retarded and be able to do most things in life, or they may be moderately or severely or extremely mentally retarded. Now, that leaves how many people in this range in here? What percentage? We've got 2.5 here and 2.5 here, makes 5 total. That leaves 95% of us who have IQs between 70 and 120. The average, by the way, is about 100. And most people, specifically 68% of the population, have an IQ between 90 and 110. Most people fall right here in the middle in terms of brain power. Basically got enough to get the job done. Whatever you want to do to get through life, basically got enough to do that. Okay? Now, I'm going to parallel body type with intelligence. It's not an exact parallel, so don't misquote me. And I show up in somebody's famous book one of these days. Yeah, Dr. Durham told me that. And no, I'm not telling you that. This is just a parallel. Here's what it is, though. Think about this. There are some people in our society who, it doesn't matter how much they eat, they stay skinny. Kay is an example, right? I mean, she can put it away, and she's always tall and skinny. They're the ones we hate, right? You know? They're called ectomorphs, an ectomorphic body type. And I'm going to say that there are about 2.5% of them in our culture. There are not many of them. And there are some people down here who can live on rabbit food and stay fat. They can eat celery and lettuce out the wazoo, and they never lose weight. It's because of their body type, which we call endomorphic. Their genetics have just set them up to have a heavier body type. Yeah, a large body type, a thin body type, and the ones in the middle, a mesomorphic body type, or a middle range body type. Now, what I want to offer you is, most people in our culture are which body type? Mesomorphic. What are we all supposed to be? Ectomorphic. See, here we got 2.5% ectomorphic, and the rest of us, 97.5%, we're all trying to be this. And you haven't got a chance. You cannot change your body type. Now, if you're mesomorphic, you can change your body weight within a certain range, but you can't change your body type. And if you're endomorphic, you can change your weight and you can change your fitness, but you can't change your body type. So we got 98% of us trying to be something that only 2% of us have a chance of being. Is that a prescription for failure? I call these billboard bodies. That's really the only place they exist, is on billboards, and about 2% of the population. Most of us are not that kind of body. Now, tell me how fair it is that they ought to be the standard. That doesn't make sense, does it? Why can't this be the standard? Oh, wow, you've got a mesomorphic body. That's great. Why can't that be the standard in terms of how we define acceptance or beauty? Okay, now let's say one more word about the fitness fad. Is the fitness fad really about fitness? And if not, what is it really about? Body image, thinness, appearance, isn't it? Think about that. In North Dallas, where I moved from a couple of 3 years ago, on one of the main drags, there's a health spa, a health studio. And the entire wall of that workout gym, along this main drag in one of the ritziest parts of Dallas, is all glass. Now, what kind of a body do you have to go work out there? Are you going to go work out there if you need to work out? No, you're going to go work out there to stretch your stuff. It's a place for showing off the body you already have. So, and what I want to get across to you, and I think you'll find this true in your own life if you're honest with yourself, your exercise and your preoccupation with your fitness and your health is more about appearance than it is about health. Do you know how overweight you have to be for it to significantly endanger your health? 100 pounds. Now, if you're a little overweight, you'll start getting a little puffy when you walk up and down the hills around here. And you may not fit into some of the clothes that you want to wear. And you may be uncomfortable with the way you can do some sports. It may impair your lifestyle. But in terms of endangering your health, it takes a lot of weight to endanger your health. So why are we enslaved to what the culture tells us we ought to look like or be? It's pretty sad, isn't it? Now, let me ask you a question. Of all of the women in the United States, what percentage of them are exposed to this cultural pressure? 100% of them, right? If you live here, you know this pressure. Of all the women in the U.S. that are exposed to this pressure, how many of them have an eating disorder? About 11%. So they don't all develop an eating disorder. How come? There's got to be some other factor. And I'll call it emotional vulnerability. Think about it from this angle as well. Food, air, water. The fundamental needs for survival. And an eating disordered woman is willing to mess with 2 out of 3 of those. It's a pretty serious problem, isn't it? It disrupts your very fabric. It disturbs your identity, who you are. It messes with your sexuality. Your sexuality is involved with it. It gets at the very roots of who you are as an individual. It's not just kind of like a surface deal that'll go away. And so it's got to be something deeper than just, oh, I want to have a great body for the prom. There's got to be something else that combines with it. And I want to tell you what 2 or 3 of those things are. First one, significant loss in the family. Now, it may have been the death of somebody in the family that you're real close to and that they were real supportive of you and that left you with an emptiness inside. That left you vulnerable, that is, emotionally looking for some answer to that emptiness, to that loss, to the sadness. And the logical thing is, well, maybe people would love me if I just looked better. And so that death leaves you empty, and the emptiness sets you up to use culture's answer to being loved. You see that relate? You see that connection? Now, it may not have been a death. It may have been a geographical location, relocation, especially if it were at what we call a developmentally critical period. If there was a time in your life in which you were right at one of those stages of growth, like entering puberty, and there was this massive change in your life that left you without friends, and you got to develop a whole new set of friends, and maybe it was maybe you're going into 6th grade, which is a tough year for a lot of kids, and then you started puberty, and the family moved, and it leaves you wondering about who you are, or if you're good enough, or if people are going to accept you or love you. And what does the culture tell you is the way to find love? Get skinny. So it sets you up again, see, for that connection between emotional vulnerability and the development of an eating disorder. It can be the disintegration of the family. Disintegration. There we go. Let me say a word for moms and dads. If the family falls apart, the fact is it will have an impact on the kids. Period. It just will. Now, and let me say it in a shorthand kind of way. If there's a divorce in the home, when the young girl is prepubescent, she's in grade school or kindergarten, and there's a divorce. She loses one of her parents' voice. And in that stage of growth, prepubescent, when a kid's identity is developing, she's developing a sense of who she is, separate from who mom is and from who dad is, developing a sense of her own identity, there's one voice that she's listening for more than the other for the blessing of that identity, and that's mom. She's listening for moms to say, I'm glad you're developing your own identity, that you're not just a carbon copy of me.
I like it that you're different. I like it that you have your own likes and dislikes and your own feelings and your own beliefs. I like seeing you develop a different identity. Now, once a young girl goes into puberty, or a young boy, they begin to listen for dad's voice for the blessing of their emerging sexual identity, gender identity. It's dad's voice that boys and girls are both listening for. It says, wow, you're becoming a woman, a man. I love what I'm seeing. It's so neat to see you growing up. Now, if your dad isn't in your life when you're in that area, how is that going to leave you empty? In the area of your gender identity, in the area of your sexual identity, in your comfort with your developing sexuality, you're not going to have that blessing from dad if he's not in your life. If your mom isn't in your life when you're little, it leaves you with a wondering about your sense of identity as a person. Either stage of life, if the family falls apart, your development is going to be harmed. Okay? So that's going to be there. That's going to leave you vulnerable emotionally. You're going to be looking for an answer that you don't have. Now, I mean, that's real easy to see. You got a teenage girl, newly developing sexuality, without a dad who's saying, oh, it's looking great, and I love seeing you develop a woman into a woman, and let me help you learn how to stay safe and how to relate to guys. And she's not getting that. Where's she going to go get it? Where's she going to go get it? Particularly, what part of society? Other boys. Other men. Because remember, it's a male voice that she's listening for. And if she doesn't get it from dad, she'll go get it from somebody. She'll go find some man who can say, I like what you got, baby. Only he may not be interested in keeping her safe. He might just be interested in using her newly developing sexuality. So it leaves her at risk. But she's still going to go looking for it. And how do you get a guy's attention? Have a body. Get skinny. And so it connects you again back to being set up to develop an eating disorder. One more factor in this emotional vulnerability that I'll deal with right now. Harsh discipline in the home can oftentimes leave a person emotionally vulnerable. Here's what I mean. If you're in the Marines, do they particularly care whether or not you feel like following instructions? No. They just want you to do it. The emphasis is on conformity or compliance, obedience. Now, real frankly, in the armed services, I'm glad it's that way. If you're on the front lines, that's not the right time to have a process group about whether or not you want to do what the lieutenant says. You know? So you just do it. See, I mean, there's some real important situations in life in which instant obedience is what's wanted. If my kid's in the middle of the street and I yell, move, why do I want him to move? That's right. I don't want him to sit there and say, Dad, could you give me the existential philosophy behind why you want me to get out of the street? Just move. So, however, you may have had a dad who tried to run the home like he ran his platoon. And what that does in the home is it communicates the same message it did in the armed service. I don't really care how you feel. All I care about is that you obey. So the emphasis gets put on conformity or compliance or going through the motions regardless of what's going on inside you. Now, if they don't take your feelings seriously, are you going to? You'll be trained not to take your feelings seriously. You will be trained to ignore what's going on the inside and only worry about what's going on the outside. So when your culture says, I want you thin, blonde, and blue-eyed, you're going to go, oh my gosh, I better go dye my hair and get tinted contacts and get on a diet. You're going to be set up to conform to whatever the culture tells you. If your parents said, children are to be seen and not heard, see, that message says, we really don't care what you have to say. All we care about is that you look right for our family portrait.
if the message was, you can come out of your room as soon as you can put a smile back on your face. Did you get that one? I got that one some. See, the emphasis is not on, you sound upset, let's talk about it. The emphasis is on smile, right? Just smile. Now, there are rules in my family. There are ways my kids can talk to me, and there are ways my kids can't talk to me. I'm not advocating that kids ought to be given permission to say whatever on their mind and however they want to say it. They need guidelines from parents. You know what grows without guidance? Weeds. You got weeds as kids, it's probably because they didn't have guidance in how to grow. Children need guidance. They need guidance in how to do their anger with a parent, or how to do their sadness, or how to do their frustration, or how to do their happiness. They need guidance. Great, I'm glad you're having a good time, but you can't write on the walls. You know? I mean, they need guidance. However, if the guidance says, all I care about is what's on the outside, then they will get that message, and that's all they'll care about, is what's on the outside. Now, aren't you glad God doesn't work that way? Aren't you glad God doesn't judge you just on what you do, on what's on the outside? Remember that scripture in the Old Testament? God looks on the heart to know the ways of a man. Now, sometimes that's kind of threatening because we want to hide our hearts from him. He's like, ooh, I hope he doesn't know that one about me. But he does. But it's really comforting. He knows your heart. He knows your intentions. He cares about your feelings, about your intentions, about your thoughts. He doesn't just care about the end product. When he grows you from, Larry Crabb's phrases, from the inside out. He wants you developing on the inside. That way you won't be emotionally vulnerable to the pressure of your culture. Now, let's talk about when it goes wrong, though. When these two things combine, the result is a felt sense of loss of control. A felt sense of loss of control. I say felt sense because it may not look to somebody else like anything's out of control. But if you feel like you're out of control and your life's out of control, then it counts. Because it's that the way you experience it that matters the most. Now let's translate that up here to the next diagram. Loss of control. Let's use a single mom as an example. She's newly divorced. She's working through the grief of losing her marriage. She's trying to build a new life for herself, new social life. She may be back in school trying to figure out how to earn a living. She's got a kid or two or three. She's trying to handle child care and finances and her social life. And, oh, by the way, maybe I ought to get a spiritual life. And does it sound out of control yet? It does sound out of control, doesn't it? You've been there, one way or another. Business got overwhelming. Your relationship broke up. You didn't know how to keep your job going. You maybe moved in a new marriage all at once. And it's like, ugh, where is anything nailed down? And the answer may have been no. Now, the natural response is to try to figure out something to get a handle on. If I could just get something going in the right direction, maybe I could get this whole thing turned around and my life would improve. So you start looking for just anything that you can do something about. And here's the logical one. Maybe if I could just lose some weight, I could get my life going. Have you ever said that? I mean, here's this single mom. If I could just lose a few pounds, I wouldn't spend so much money on food, so my finances would be improved, and I'd feel better about myself, so maybe I'd go out more, and maybe I'd get more attractive, and so he'd ask me out, and maybe you'd get... So I'm going to try it. So I'm going to do what? Get on a diet. You know the best way to gain weight? Isn't that the truth? How many of you have ever been on only one diet in your life? I mean, if you've been on one, you've been on a million. Eating disordered women usually know the most about diets because they've been through them all that don't work. You can't do just one. And remember why you were dieting in the first place, to lose weight and to do something about the problems in your life, to get them out of control. But what really happens when you go on a diet? You get hungry. So you get hungry, plus your problems get worse because you weren't doing anything about them. You're expecting your weight to solve all the problems in your life. So the problems are getting worse. You're getting hungry. What do you turn to for comfort? It's as logical as falling off a log. And if you're eating disordered, that food solace is going to become a binge. What do you feel when you first binge?
Guilt.
Absolute guilt. I can't believe it. And so you do something about the guilt. That's why you purge. Now, initially, your purging might have just been starving. That's one of the most common ways. Oh, I can't believe I ate that. Well, I'm just not going to eat any dinner. And so you don't. So by breakfast the next morning, you're in a hurry anyway, so you grab a cup of coffee and you don't eat anything either. What do you do at lunch? You go for it, don't you? And you eat more than you meant to. And it's like, oh, well, I've blown it today, so you do it again at dinner. And the next day you get up and you say, man, I can't believe I had two meals out of control. I am not eating anything today. And you're off and running, aren't you? Okay? Now, what do you feel when you finally learn to purge? You finally learn how to get rid of all that calories and you feel relief. You feel instant relief. It's like, at least that's one meal I don't have to live with. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you're aware of the fact that most purging, vomiting and laxative abuse, really don't work as weight control after a while. Do you know why? Your body metabolism slows down when you stop keeping that food in. Your body interprets it as, oh my gosh, there must be a famine in the land. There's not enough food. We're going to have to learn to live on less food. So your body metabolism slows down, gets more efficient at burning the calories, and so you don't lose weight even though you're eating less. In fact, you may have gained weight even though you're purging more and more frequently. That's why, because your body is designed to keep you alive. Okay? So initially you feel some relief. What else do you feel? Back in control. You might feel some shame, but you usually make that feeling go away pretty well. And you feel relief and back in control, and now I'm back on top of things. Now I'm just going to get back on my diet. Now, isn't that tragic? See, that's an eating disorder. Now, you remember what set you up to feel out of control was that emotional vulnerability. And what you ladies who are eating disordered need to be able to do is identify what the occurrences were. What were the wounds that left you so emotionally vulnerable? Were they family? Were they sexual abuse? Were they rape? Were they a family that taught you to ignore feelings? Were they changes in your life that left you feeling absolutely worthless? What were the triggers that left you so vulnerable that you responded to the illusion that the culture gives you, if you'll just get skinny, all your problems will go away? Once you've begun that process, it keeps itself alive, doesn't it? Your eating disorder may have very little to do with what you originally started it for. We talk about two sets of factors, the development factors of your eating disorder, what got the ball rolling, and the maintenance factors of your eating disorder, what keeps it going. And you've got to do something about both sets of factors. On your truth and love lists that you do as homework for Family Week, there's a new page that will be attached this week. And it says this: things besides Family Week I still need to work on. Because I want you to remember that all of those factors that left you vulnerable and that kept it going all need addressing, not just fixing the family, quote-unquote, during Family Week. Now, let me add two more comments and we'll quit. Here's the first one. I left out a third eating disorder because it's technically not an eating disorder at this time. It, however, is probably the most common eating disorder. And what is it?
Compulsive
overeating. Now, here's why I left it out. Not every person who's overweight is a compulsive overeater. Is obesity a psychiatric disorder, an eating disorder? No, it's not. Obesity is a medical diagnosis. It just means overweight. Okay? Technically, it means 15% overweight, at least, I think. Like anorexia means 15% underweight. Okay? So it's just a medical diagnosis. Of all the people who are overweight, we estimate that as many as maybe 40% of them might be eating disordered. That is, a compulsive overeater. Now, here's the best way to understand that eating disorder. If you'll call the compulsive overeater, if you'll call her a non-purging bulimic, then you'll understand. She binges, she eats for the same reasons a bulimic does. She just doesn't purge. That makes her eating disordered. Okay. Now, do we treat compulsive overeating here at Ramuda? Yeah, we do. But not as commonly as anorexia and bulimia for two reasons. The first one is, a lot of times people who are overweight want to come into treatment just to lose weight. And we tell them when they call, if you're lucky, you may lose some weight while you're here. Now, I don't mean lucky, but, and we'll help you. We'll put you on a slow weight loss program, maybe a pound or two or three a week, not much. If it gets any faster than that, we'll give you more food. Because we do not want the emphasis on weight loss. We want the emphasis on heart healing. So this isn't a weight loss spa. And number two, compulsive overeating is not usually as life-endangering as anorexia and bulimia. So it usually doesn't necessitate hospital treatment as much as anorexia and bulimia do. Those are generalized statements, and there are exceptions to those, but those are generally true. And then finally, I want to talk just to you about how you deal with eating disorders. Several different things. First one is you got to deal with the behavior. If you're still binging and purging, guess what? You're still eating disordered. If you're still starving or restricting your food intake or compulsively exercising or whatever your symptom pattern is, guess what? You're still eating disordered. You can do all the psychobabble you want to. You can love therapy and really get some insight in your life. And if you're still eating disordered, you're still eating disordered. Ernie Larson says in his book, Stage 2 Recovery, something real profound, if nothing changes, nothing changes. The behavior's got to change. Now, I know the favorite part of our treatment program here for you is our level system, right? Right. Make you throw up, right? I know the level system is sometimes very frustrating. Yeah, I know. Because it puts some pressure on you to help that behavior change. Now, can you still throw up here? Absolutely. There's a million bushes out there. If you want to go throw up behind one. Can you still compulsively exercise? Yeah. Can you restrict your food intake? Yeah. We can't make you stop being an eating disordered individual. We can make it more uncomfortable for you to be eating disordered and help you change. We can give you opportunities to do something else about your feelings other than do your eating disorder about your feelings. But we can't make you stop. So the level system is designed to help put that pressure on the behaviors so that you change the behaviors. Is that enough? No. A behavioral treatment of eating disorders does not work over the long haul. You've also got to get that emotional vulnerability, that heart woundedness, healed. You've got to get the root issues identified and the healing process well underway if you want the behavioral changes to stick. So that's two. Third one. Is spirituality optional with respect to eating disorder treatment? No. And I'll tell you why. It's not just because I'm a Christian. I want to make it even broader than that. This is the bad news. You think being eating disordered has been tough. You wait till you try recovery. Recovery is tougher. It's easier to just give in to your old way of doing it. Causes a lot of pain and doesn't have near the joy that being in recovery does. But recovery is tough. It's going to take so much energy that you're going to have a reason why you're recovering, or you won't. You won't stick it out. Spirituality is what gives human beings a reason. It gives us a purpose and a meaning and a focus for our lives. And if you don't have it, you won't stay in recovery. So you've got to get a strong sense of spirituality in your life as you leave here. Now, we define that here at Ramuda specifically in Christian terms. Not exclusively. We're not going to kick you out if you don't get saved. That's not our purpose. Our purpose is to find the blocks in your life to your spiritual growth, help get those out of your way so that you leave here closer to God than you came in. Whatever that means. I don't know what that will mean for you. Now, if you do become a Christian while you're here, we can handle that. We can help you do that too. But the focus is, the purpose is, what are you doing about God in your life? We want to help you figure that out. So that's three: behavior, emotion, spirituality. Fourth one: what are the most significant relationships in your life? They're family, aren't they? Yeah. Parents and family. Even if your parents are dead, they're still the most significant relationships in your mind, in your life. They still shape, you know, you find yourself ever doing,
oh, I swore I'd never do that like she did or like he did. And you're doing it. They are the most significant relationships in your life. So family relationships have got to be addressed for successful treatment of eating disorders. That's why we do Family Week, see? Because we want to help those relationships in your life become a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. Because they are that significant in your life. That's enough. Thank you for your attention.